If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. The 17th century was a turbulent time for England, overshadowed by civil war, coups, and regicide, as well as the looming threats of terrorism, invasion, plague, and witch panics. However, in the coffee shops and on the street corners of growing cities, the common people finally had their voices heard, and those voices were loud. Speaking with Emily Briffitt, Jonathan Healy, the author of a new book, Blazing World, challenges the perception that this was a dull, complicated age, to illuminate a revolutionary society that helped forge modern Britain.
So we're today going to be talking all about your new book, The Blazing World. Now, this covers the tumultuous 17th century. So to start off, can you give us a quick rundown of the key events of the 17th century that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so the 17th century is just an incredibly complicated century. And I think one that quite a lot of people, if they're not, sort of academic specialists, look at and think, oh, my word, no, that's too complicated. There's so much going on. All the characters are really complicated. There's no one that I really like. I can't decide whether I'm a roundhead or a cavalier. I can't decide whether I think the Glorious Revolution was a good thing. So it's a very, very, as you say, tumultuous century, and that makes it a very complicated century. And I think what I'm trying to do in The Blazing World is to tell that story in an engaging and an entertaining and enjoyable way. It's a century in which we see England at the beginning is ruled by a very complicated, very interesting, very unfathomable Scottish monarch, James VI of Scotland, who becomes James I of England, a very intelligent man, a peacemaker who is eventually forced to join a continental war that he really doesn't want to be involved in. For he's pulled into it by kind of family reasons, but also because of the sort of pressure from people at home who want to get involved. Then his younger son, the spare, if you like, Charles, who is a fascinating, poorly understood character. Most people know what happens to him. He's famously the king who starts off at sort of 5'2" and ends up shorter at the end of his reign because of reasons that we will go into. And therefore he's kind of seen as sort of, you know, a bad king, an unsuccessful. I mean, you know, by definition, if you get executed by your people, then, you know, you're unsuccessful. But I really want to kind of tell a more nuanced picture about Charles and really kind of try and understand why things go so badly wrong for him and the country falls into civil war. And for me, it's not just about the competence of the rulers, but I think Charles is also at the mercy of much deeper forces, which are ones that I'm trying to talk about in this book. And then, of course, you get the Civil War and the regicide and 1647, which I think is the most fascinating year in English history. It's where the army takes control. England comes really, really close to a proper social revolution. You get discussions of democracy, all these kind of things. Fascinating period. There's then an experiment in republicanism, which we're supposed to sort of look back on now these days and say, oh, it was a terrible failure. This country is just not suited to being a republic. I don't think that's true. I think we need to understand it in its own terms. There were lots of reasons that the republic struggled and lots of different forces. There's also, of course, the titanic, very problematic figure of Oliver Cromwell right at the beginning. And, you know, I can't get my head around Oliver Cromwell. No one, you know, it's been 350 years. No one has yet got their head around Oliver Cromwell. I hope this book will give readers some tools with which they can make their own decisions. You then get the, of course, the monarchy is restored, the republic fails in the long term, and you get the rule of Charles II, followed by his brother James II, whose rule then collapses. And I think, again, that sort of restoration period is one that, I mean, it's a great story. There's lots of great incident, not just the Great Fire of London and the plague. We all know about that, but also the exclusion crisis, which I think is, you know, utterly fascinating. You get the birth of political parties. In many ways, it's sort of rehash of the issues of the Civil War. And, you know, the reign of Charles II is again, it's something which, you know, the sort of view in the popular press is often it's sort of, you know, kind of playboy fun kind of stuff. But also there's an awful lot of repression. There's an awful lot of political conflict. There's a lot of also, kind of, you know, deeper questions about economic change and things like that, which I want to talk about. So the book is all about that. It's all about those great events. It ends with the Glorious Revolution, in which there's a Dutch invasion, which is also sort of a revolution. Again, I want my readers to make their own minds up about that. I sort of have my views. I think it's more revolutionary than we think. So I'm trying to tell this story. I'm also trying to write political history with society put back into it. Throughout the book, I'm drawing lots and lots of examples from ordinary people who have really quite nuanced, really quite thoughtful political and religious, constitutional, legal views, and people who engage in politics, and also these kind of deeper changes in society which are altering the lives of ordinary people, economic change, development of things like poor relief, local events in the church which people are really quite engaged in. So there's a lot there. It's a big story. This is a book about England, and I think one of the real glories of recent work on this period is that England, we no longer understand it in isolation, and there's not just the sort of the histories which have looked at Scotland and Ireland and the relationship between the three kingdoms, if you like, but also recent work, most famously Devilland, which of course won the Wolfson Prize, which has really kind of done loads of stuff to integrate the English story into an international context. And that's all really, really important. But this book is very, very much about England itself. It's about what's going on within England. It's about the way that English people engage with their government. You know, much as it's very, very important to tell Scottish history, to tell Welsh history, I think it's also quite important in this period to accept that England was a unified state, a unified country, which needs to be partly at least tackled on its own terms. So it's sort of, you know, it will probably irk people who want a really kind of wide-ranging canvas. It is very much focused on England, but I do think that is has its own validity. I think you know, the history of particular countries within the archipelago is valid. It has to be done. It's not for everyone, but it has to be done.
What state was English governance at this time, at the start of the 17th century? What are we looking at?
It's a brilliant question. And the answer is, as all historians will always tell you, is very, very complicated. England in 1600 is an incredibly rich country. And people don't really get that. You know, in a lot of popular history books on this period, we tend to think of England as being sort of poor, peripheral, unimportant. But that's only part of the story. The state is poor. The monarchy is poor, but the people are actually pretty wealthy, or at least there's a lot of wealth going around. It's not very evenly distributed, but there's a lot of wealth going around. And that in some ways is the sort of the fundamental problem at the start of the 17th century. There's lots and lots of money. When James I comes down from Scotland, he passes through the east of England, which is the really sort of rich arable golden fields. And all these people come up from Cambridge in their gowns and their paraphernalia of office, their gold chains and all this kind of stuff. And he sort of looks at it and he sort of thinks, well, this country is incredibly rich. They're very, very wealthy. They're making loads of food, they've got loads of trade, they've got really nice clothes. I mean, he doesn't think in these terms, but in terms of GDP per capita, England at this point is incredibly wealthy. But that's all well and good, but the government can't get its grubby mitts on it, because there is this kind of complicated constitutional arrangement whereby, as a general rule, the government can't take people's money without getting their consent for it. And that consent is given by Parliament. And that James finds quite difficult to deal with. And there are lots and lots of other kind of things going on at this point, which is just making it a lot harder for the central government. You know, the price of stuff is going up, it's inflation, the cost of warfare is going up. James has this kind of incredibly large royal household, and he's also got this kind of tendency to pay off all the debts of all these Scottish courtiers who he likes. So he's very, very, he's a very expensive guy, and government more generally is becoming much more expensive, and especially when there are wars to fight. And that kind of creates this tension whereby the government is very poor, but it realizes that there's this really wealthy country that it can that should be taking money from, and it wants to get that money. But of course, to do so, it has to argue with the representatives of the people in Parliament. And that then becomes one of the defining constitutional problems of the period. When can the central government take people's money? And when can it take people's money without first getting their consent?
So can we dive into that a little bit more? What was the relationship like between those in power and the general populace?
Again, that's a really, really good question. And historians recently have sort of complicated as we do. And the question of who's in power is a really, really interesting one for this period, because, I mean, there's a central government and there's a king. And the king has his main officers. So, you know, the Lord Treasurer, for example, the Lord Chancellor. And, you know, he has his sort of legal team. He's got an Attorney General. He's got, you know, all these kind of guys who are at the centre of government. They have offices in Whitehall and or around the royal court. And they're the ones who are kind of making the day-to-day decisions, the people on the Privy Council. In order to get money and in order to pass legislation, i.e. to change the law, they need to work with Parliament. And that expands the political nation even further, depending on what period you're looking at. There's about 500 people in Parliament by the middle of the century. And as I say, to get money, as a general rule, not in all cases, to get money, they need to go to Parliament and also to pass laws. So if they need to change the law, the accepted way of doing it is through Parliament. There are some people who argue the king can change the law by royal proclamation, but that's an outlying argument, I think. But then we're talking about a state which has not really much bureaucracy, no standing army yet. By the end of the 17th century, it's got a standing army, no police force, no professional police force. So how does it actually enforce this stuff? Well, it does so by co-opting local people. And these are often quite ordinary people. So the gentry, who are, you know, quite wealthy guys in the provinces, they're involved in county government. And then below them, at the parish level, each parish has church wardens, it has overseers of the poor who deal with welfare policy, it has constables who deal with, you know, it's the constable who has to close down the unruly alehouses which stay open beyond 9 p.m. That's not an easy job. And these guys are, and they are almost all men, but women take part in the political nation as well as things like as witnesses in the law courts. And there's a hugely complicated legal system which allows the country to be governed. So that question of who is governing and who is not governing is a very, very complicated one. This idea that because the state, and by that I don't mean the government, I'm distinguishing it from the state. The government is the people at the top who are making the decision. The state is the apparatus which puts those decisions into play. Because the state is so kind of wide and so many quite ordinary people are involved in it, they are particularly likely to get opinions about it. And one of the biggest connections, if you like, between centre and localities is religion. And that's one of those things we find very, very hard to get our heads around. But the government at this point is saying things about the organisation of religion, about the liturgy, about the organisation of the church, which are controversial. And it's things like, where do you place the communion table? Do you place it in the middle of the church where it's accessible to everyone, but therefore, you know, people can put their babies, can change their babies on it? You know, that's something that people do. Or do you rail it off and put it at the end of the church like a Catholic altar? And then it's much more, you know, it's much more decorous, it's much more refined, but it's also set apart from the people. And that, to us, feels kind of quite sort of, you know, almost quite sort of esoteric in lots and lots of ways. We live in a much more secular age. But at the time, that kind of issue cut right through to the heart of how a lot of people saw their relationship with God, with the apparatus of the church, and of course with the king. And one thing I'm trying to do in The Blazing World is to get or modern people to understand how sort of, you know, how controversial this stuff was to often quite ordinary people in the period. It mattered, all this stuff.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What opportunities did the common people have to have their say and have their voice heard?
There are lots of kind of formal ways that common people, ordinary people, had of engaging with government. And one of the main ones is getting involved in the legal system. The legal system is so huge and kind of, you know, has, you know, tentacles going all across the country. There's one historian, a guy called Craig Muldrew, who calculated, it's a wonderful calculation, I love it, I'll bring it up whenever I can, that on average, every single family in England in the 1600 was involved in about one lawsuit per year. I mean, that is a phenomenally litigious society. It sort of, you know, it makes contemporary America look like the Teletubbies. I mean, it's just a really litigious society, and that's one of the main ways people can actually engage with the state by suing each other and by engaging with the legal system. But there's also things like petitioning, which, of course, today, you know, what with websites the government website, they encourage petitions. You know, James I did as well, as long as they were from the right kind of people. And in the 17th century, petitioning takes off as a really big thing. And that's not necessarily, you know, big petitions to Parliament saying you must change this particular direction of royal policy. It's often local petitions about, you know, we think this old lady, she's not a witch. She's been accused of witchcraft, but she's not. She's great. We like her. She's brilliant. She's a great laugh down the pub. We love her. She's not a witch. Please stop that prosecution for her for witchcraft. Or you know, this old man here, he's very deserving of poor relief. He needs poor relief. He should get it. Or this guy here, he's a layabout. He shouldn't get poor relief. You know, all this stuff. There's all this kind of stuff going on day to day. That said, there is also in this period a really big development of massive public petitions. And they really kind of start in the 1620s when it's often women who are petitioning to get the state involved in releasing their husbands from captivity overseas. That's one of the first things people petition about. But certainly by the 1640s in particular, mass petitioning becomes a really constant presence in national politics, and you know, just like it was after 2016, after the referendum, Westminster, the Palace of Westminster, was very frequently in the 1640s crowded around with people petitioning, protesting, and of course, you know, petitioning and protesting, they kind of shade into each other. And there's also a very rich tradition of popular protests in this period. And, you know, I start with talking about revolts against enclosure, the enclosure of land, which was, you know, a significant issue in the early 17th century. And by the middle of the 17th century, there's this sort of great sort of mass movements in London about abolishing bishops, about opposing the king, and then actually eventually in favour of the king. There's a sort of, you know, there's a moment in 1647, the most interesting year in English history, where there was a conservative mob invaded Parliament and caused all kinds of trouble. So that kind of popular protest, and as you know, one of the things I'm trying to sort of bring out is that popular protest in this period, it doesn't necessarily come from the revolutionary left, if you like. There's a lot of conservative protest, pro-royalist and pro-Tory protest by the end of the period. The important thing is not that there's, you know, that there's a kind of bubbling up of a particular ideology coming from the people. The important thing is that people are getting political opinions much more so than they had before, and this makes England much more difficult to govern. The classic example of that is, of course, when in 1642, just before the start of the Civil War, Charles I infamously came into the House of Commons and tried to arrest five MPs, found that they'd all legged it. And then over the next few days, he went into the City of London, tried to get them again, and was opposed by these massive crowds of people. And there's this, you know, these kind of incredible moment where his coach is sort of trundling along the rutted streets of the City of London, and someone throws a pamphlet into it saying, you know, "To your tents, O Israel," and it's all very much a call to arms against a tyrannical monarch. And Charles, understandably is terrified by this popular uprising, and you know, hot foots it down to Hampton Court and never comes back to London until they're going to put him on trial. And that's one way of reading that is that this is a sort of, you know, the anointed monarch is terrified by this, you know, baying mob. But my way is that this is a really kind of powerful expression of popular power, people power, where the English people, the people of London in particular, are standing up to their monarch. And it's an important moment, whichever way you look at it.
What do you think then caused this growth in making it a more politically engaged society?
There's loads going on. And the obvious thing is print and literacy. And that's the first thing. I'll cover that. And I'm going to say something a little bit different. But print and literacy, I think, is really, really important. Now, of course, historians are always talking about, you know, new forms of media, revolutionising politics, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. And print, of course, goes back to the 15th century in the West. So it's not exactly new. But what is new in the 17th century is the way that print is used. And in a way, the way I sort of think about it is it's a bit like the internet. And I know that's probably an analogy that gets used all the time and it's tired and boring, but it sort of works. And the reason I think it sort of works for the 17th century in particular is that in the early days of the internet, it was all quite clunky. I mean, looking back, there was emails, there was news websites, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it made massive changes. But what really changed it in political terms was the advent of social media. So different uses of the internet. So things like Facebook in the mid-noughties, and then of course Twitter in 2009, whenever it was. And the 17th century is a bit like that, in that print has been there for a long time now. But what's new in the 17th century is, A, there's a load more of it. The number of publications is rocketing. B, more people can read them because literacy is growing. And C, there are new forms, you know, there's much more visual stuff. In particular, in the mid-17th century, you get serialization, periodization, so the growth of newspapers. And that sort of creates a kind of relationship of trust between publications and people, which of course is hugely abused by journalists, as you can imagine, but it's there, and that makes the political content of this stuff much more explosive. And then of course you've also got new spaces as well, and the classic in this period is of course the coffee house, which is a late 17th century development. And you really can see by the late 17th century, particularly with the reign of Charles II and the exclusion crisis, people. And it's mostly men, but we don't want to exclude women from this, because in the revolutionary period, in the middle of the 17th century, it's often women who are on street corners selling newspapers. You know, the Levellers, this kind of radical proto-democratic movement, they really did rely on female newspaper sellers. So women are there. They're a bit harder to see in the records, but they're definitely there, although they're probably less present in coffee houses than you might see. But anyway, you know, the sort of space in a way, coffee houses are sort of like the social media space. So anyway, so there's new ways of using the media. But the other thing I just want to kind of really highlight is the sort of deep lying social change, which makes this stuff more accessible, makes politics more accessible. And one part of that is the growth of London. You know, London is, in the time of Henry VIII, London has about 80,000 people. It would fit in Wembley Stadium today. By the reign of Charles I, it's got about 400,000 people. So it's about the size of Manchester today. It's a big city. It's a really big place. And it continues to grow by the end of the 17th century. It's about 550,000 by 1700. And that places a lot of ordinary people cheek by jowl with the institutions of government, with Whitehall, with the Palace of Westminster, and quite close to the monarchy. Of course, you know, when Charles I is coming into conflict with Parliament, one of the things that happens is that he hears people talking about him out of his window at Whitehall. You know, at this point, Whitehall was a palace. It wasn't the centre of, it was the centre of monarchy and government. Of course, now by the 18th century, it's the centre of government, but not monarchy. And that distinction, of course, is a new one then. But that physical presence of so many people in this kind of fairly confined space where, of course, you know, 90% of the English print trade is based, and of course all the law courts, all that kind of stuff, is really, really transformative. But the other thing is, from the, well, I don't know, from about 1500 to 1630-ish, the population of England is growing. And of course, that means there's more people. Fine. Okay, fair enough. But it also creates really, really interesting developments in terms of the price of stuff. It causes inflation. And in particular, the price of food goes up. So bad news if you're really, really poor. If you don't grow enough your own food, you have to buy it. Your wages are going down anyway, so you know you have to spend more of your livelihood on buying food. Bad news. But if you're a farmer who has enough money to grow enough to feed your family and sell a bit on, then you're doing really, really well. And these people, what historians tend to call the middling sort, we're very careful not to call them the middle class because it's not the same thing. They're not a bourgeoisie. They're still profoundly rural. These guys, the middling sort, are becoming more literate. They're much more likely to own books. They're the ones who are involved in local government. They're the ones who are doing quite a lot of the heavy lifting in the legal system. And therefore, they become much more politically aware. And of course, it's their younger children often who end up going to London as apprentices and, you know, living there. You know, they're the ones who become levellers and they're the ones who become diggers. But you know, the most important thing is not that they get a particular set of opinions. It's that they have opinions in the first place. They're literate. They're thinking. What do I think? You know, the king tells me this, Parliament tells me this. What do I think? What's my view? And that's the really kind of transformative thing I think that's going on.
So is it fair to say that we're maybe seeing a democratization of education and power?
So historians are very, very chary about the word democratization, and it is we're seeing something very, very, very complicated. And I think in the sense that by the end of the period, more people have more access to power than they did at the start of the period. That can be seen as a process of democratisation. What we're absolutely not saying in any sense is that by 1700, England is a democracy in any kind of modern sense. But I would say two things to caveat that. And the first is that whilst the country isn't a democracy, there is a big debate in this period. And I see it as being a kind of constant thread that runs through the period about where sovereignty comes from, where power comes from, basically. Is it ultimately given by God, invested through a monarchy, which then passes from father to son, etc., by the natural line of succession? Or does it come from the people? And that is a debate which, you know, which goes way back. It goes way, way back. And it's not new to the 17th century. But what does seem to be sort of newer is that there are more people who are more aggressively at the start of the period saying that actually power comes from God. But over the course of the 17th century, that argument is settled in favour of sovereignty of power coming from the people. And the people are represented in Parliament. They're not very well represented, of course, and the people don't get to vote, or most of the people don't get to vote. Virtually no women get to vote. But if we were to permit ourselves a small tidbit of the sin of Whiggery, of Whig history, you know, the idea that history is moving forward, it's progressive, we're going towards liberal democracy by the end. If we permit ourselves a small morsel of that sin, then what we can say is that if we want to get to a democracy, we need to have we need to have popular sovereignty first. And that's what gets settled in the 17th century. And it partly gets settled by the Civil War. You know, the regicide kind of shows that ultimately, if the king really, really messes up, then he can be he is subject to the law. And that's a really important thing to establish. As I say, it's not 100% new, but it's you know, it's much more clearly established. And then, of course, the Glorious Revolution, which has the added bonus of not, you know, not alienating a large proportion of the population. I mean, it does alienate large, but not because of the murder of a royal martyr, as they would say with Charles I. It's a lot less controversial. I mean, it's controversial, but it's a lot less controversial than the regicide. But what it shows is that ultimately, if a king breaks the law, then the king can be fired, can be cashiered. That's the word that they would use, but basically fired. And then, of course, the Act of Succession, which says that, which uses Parliament, and Parliament says, this is 1701, Parliament says that actually it doesn't matter where you are in the line of succession. If you're of the wrong religion, in this case Catholic, then we as Parliament can say that you forfeit the crown. and we're going to give it to this guy who's sort of, you know, 50 places down the royal succession, becomes George I. And that moment, of course, which is, you know, is the sort of, you know, it's the logical conclusion, if you like, of what's going on before, is this, it really kind of confirms this point that the monarchy is there on sufferance. It's not there from God. It's basically there because the people tolerate it. And in a way, I mean, that's still with us today, because you know, ultimately, if the monarchy becomes a burden and becomes so unpopular, and you know the people through Parliament decided to abolish it, then the monarchy would be gone. That's a product of this period. So yeah, so I mean, I don't want to kind of say that it's a democracy, but there are very, very important constitutional developments in this period, which if you were, as I say, if you were being naughty and being slightly Whiggish in your take on history, you would see as being a precursor. The other thing I just want to bring out, though, is that the Civil War is the classic thing. You know, people say, oh, the Civil War, it wasn't about democracy. You know, Oliver Cromwell wasn't a Democrat. I mean, of course he wasn't. No, actually, no one's a Democrat in this period. The parliamentarians are not fighting for democracy. They're fighting for popular sovereignty, and they're fighting for the rights of Parliament. But that's not the same thing. The complicating thing there is that I think the royalists are fighting against democracy, because both sides have these sort of great bogeymen that they say that they're fighting against. And the parliamentarians say it's absolutism and Catholicism. Now, you know, Charles I is an absolutist, let's be honest. He's not a Catholic, although his wife is. But the parliamentarians, for their propaganda, as a way of kind of engaging their supporters, they have to say, oh, you know, there's all these Catholics who are changing the English church. It's not true, but that's the way that they sell their point of view. The royalists also have to sell their point of view. They have to sell themselves. They have to engage with the people to get support. And the way they do it is they say that, well, the parliamentarians are all radical religious lunatics. You know, they're all just, you know, men and women standing on tubs in the centre of London talking complete nonsense. We can't have these ordinary people talking about religion. That's just ridiculous. That's what they argue. But also, they claim that the parliamentarians are Democrats. They're saying that the parliamentarians would take away this kind of old, traditional, stable, strong and stable political constitution, and they would overthrow it and everything would be at the whim of the people. And to a very, very large majority of the sort of, you know, the kind of broadly sort of conservative gentry you know, middling sort and you know, lots of people across the social scale, the idea of popular rule, of democracy, is a very, very terrifying bogeyman, and the royalists play that up. So I have, one of the things I try and say in The Blazing World is that the, you know, this old idea that the Civil War is not about democracy is not quite true. It's the parliamentarians are not fighting for it, although some of them end up doing, you know, the levellers do. But the royalists are fighting against it. They use it as a bogeyman. So I think that's really, really interesting. And it gives us a real kind of insight into the way that this century is seeing popular political engagement destabilise things in a really, really big way.
Do you think that it would have been possible to have had an active monarchy and a politicised people at the same time? Or is that just a no-go?
I mean, they try and make it work. In a sense, it's one of the conclusions of the book, which is that because the people become politicised and have all these kind of very, very different views about things, you know, about religion, about the origins of power, et cetera, the monarchy, which really kind of to survive has to stay above this stuff because it has to be acceptable to the people as a whole, and it has to be acceptable to people of different political views. You know, as much as I don't want to push this argument too far, one of the reasons that the monarchy has survived in the into the modern era is that the monarchy has sort of pulled back from frontline politics. I mean, you know, everything's political in a sense, isn't it, of course, but that, you know, the monarchy is not sort of marching into Parliament and saying you should vote for these people, and they can't, they, you know, if they started doing that, then I think, you know, hopefully I'd think that we would say no, that's not an acceptable course. So given that, for monarchy to survive into a more modern context, it has to be sort of set apart from politics. The problem it has in the 17th century is that politics more broadly has become so divided, and you know, classically, by of course the end of the period, you've got Whigs and Tories, the two political parties, who have, you know, I mean, they're mostly from the same social background. They're mostly from the same kind of class, if you like, but they have very different constitutional and religious views. You know, they don't just, I mean, there's plenty of people who go between, but there's always people like that, but essentially they have two quite different political and religious views, and the monarchy prefers one to the other. It prefers the Tories as a general rule until the Glorious Revolution. It prefers the Tories because they're the loyalist ones, and they're the ones who, you know, they're not connected to all these dissenters who, of course, the royalists don't like very much. So by the end of Charles II's reign, and it's not really Charles II's fault. I mean, he starts off trying to be this kind of, you know, all things to all men, and indeed women. But by the end of the period, because of the exclusion crisis, because you've got this development of political parties, and because one of them is trying to use Parliament to change the laws of succession, which is very, very, you know, very radical thing to do. Charles II basically sort of says, right, OK, I am going to nail myself to the Tory cause. And he cultivates support from the Tories. He politically outmaneuvers the Whigs. And by 1685, what was a sort of a universal monarchy, if you like, or at least sort of mostly universal, as it had been in 1660, has become a Tory monarchy, basically. And then, of course, James II makes a complete hash of that by alienating the Tories as well. So the reason that he falls is that ultimately he sort of, he annoys his core supporters in the Tory party. But I think that idea that the monarchy is kind of pegging itself to one particular political viewpoint makes an activist politicized monarchy much, 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 much harder, because you're ultimately going to alienate a large proportion of the population. And that goes back as well. It doesn't just come out of nowhere under Charles II. It goes back to Charles I, of course, you know, by the 1640s. Of course, he's a party leader. He's not a king. He's a party leader. He's leading a royalist party. But that sort of goes back to his actions in the 1630s in particular. And you know, Charles I is a man who has lots and lots of very complicated views. He's a in many ways he's very Puritan. He's very civilized. He likes his art. He doesn't want everything out of order. He certainly doesn't like people, you know, drinking and cavorting in the way that his father had. But what he really hates is Puritans in the church. He doesn't like people who want a more stripped back form of worship. He doesn't like active involvement by congregations. He doesn't really like people going away and doing their own private prayer. He wants people to accept what the bishops have told them. The bishops are very, very important to Charles. He's very much sort of anti-Puritan. And that means that he intervenes in this kind of really complicated, essentially kind of culture war that's going on in the early 17th century between people who sort of see their relationship with their neighbours as being more important and people who see their relationship with God being more important. That's two very different views. And the classic example of that is the Book of Sports, which Charles issues in 1633. It's actually taken from something his father did. And it basically says, quite innocuous, really. It sounds quite innocuous to do. It's fine to play football and do other kind of lawful forms of recreation on a Sunday after church. Fine. No problem at all. With that, he says every minister has to read this in their church. They have to make it clear to their congregations that you can play football on a Sunday. Fine. No problem. But this is very, very controversial because lots of people believe that the Sunday should be kept completely for religious instruction. The Sabbath day. Honour the Sabbath. That's a very, very important thing. And Charles just kind of wades into this thing, and instead of just sort of saying, well, this is what I prefer, but you know, you do you, which is what his father does, he says, not only do you have to take my view on this very, very controversial, very difficult issue, but if you don't, then I will fire your minister. And that he's just wading into this stuff and becoming, like I say, becoming a party leader, becoming the leader of a particular kind set of opinion rather than a national leader. And I think the monarchy finds it difficult to navigate those waters in this period. There's just so much controversy, and the monarchy doesn't yet realise that it has to just step back and say, you know, fine, we're just going to poodle around in Whitehall and do our thing, Buckingham Palace eventually, and you guys sort out the politics down in Westminster. They don't do that yet.
With all that in mind, what echoes of the 17th century do you think we still see today?
I mean, it's not a question I like, I'm afraid, because I think there's a huge sort of pressure on historians, particularly when you're writing for a general audience, to sort of say, oh, well, you know, Brexit, just like the exclusion crisis, or you know, Boris Johnson is basically Charles the First, or Charles the Second. I don't know. Whoever you want to go for. I don't think he's Oliver Cromwell. And I think, you know, it's kind of fun. But I what I'm trying to do here is to write an enjoyable and engaging book which tells a really, really good, really important and really useful story. And I think that's, we don't want to lose sight of that. Nonetheless, were you to want to make contemporary allusions, I think, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting questions which are going to emerge about the role of the monarchy. You know, we had a very popular, long-standing monarch in this country, and that's now changed. And I think, in a way, a lot of those questions about what role the monarchy has in our political system, I mean, not really very much. It's more of a social role in a way. Those questions will, I think, become more, I think they have been sort of, they've been kicked into the long grass for a while. And now that there's been a change at the top, I think that might change. So I think, you know, in some ways, the really important thing about history is not to look for parallels but it's a way of looking at societies that are very different. And 17th century society is just incredibly different to our own in lots and lots of ways. And yet these people were capable of thinking about radical political change at the centre. They got rid of the monarchy. I mean, if you know, I'm not saying for a moment that we should. I mean, listeners will have their own views on this. But if they could do it, then we could. There's no particular reason why that can't happen again. As I say, I'm not saying it should. Listeners can make their own decisions. I am studiously neutral. So there's a question of the monarchy and its relation to politics as well. But I also think this. This period sees a society grappling with deep-lying social problems, deep-lying social change, inflation. There's a cost of living crisis, all that kind of stuff, and a rapidly changing kind of media landscape, and not always dealing with it very well. I mean, you know, they end up killing each other ultimately. So I don't think the 17th century provides us a roadmap of how we should deal with things like culture wars, things like, you know, new forms of media, things like questions about monarchy. It certainly doesn't. I mean, they screw it up massively. They all end up killing each other. I don't think that's a good model. But it does show how difficult some of these things are. And, you know, one of the real sort of take homes of The Blazing World, I hope, is that people 350 years ago were not less intelligent than us. They were not more ignorant than us. I mean, obviously they didn't understand science in the same way, but they had very, very complicated, very well thought out views about religion, about the world, about law. I mean, you know, the amount of kind of legal knowledge amongst ordinary people is just astonishing. It's way better than it is today. So that one lawsuit per year, I mean, you know, that will sort that out. And so these are very, very intelligent people who are dealing with a set of very, very difficult problems. And as I say, they don't do it very, very well. But I mean, you know, if the reader comes out of The Blazing World and thinks, well, oh, gosh, these terribly intelligent people had all these kind of difficult problems and they massively messed it up. Let's not be complacent in our own world about, you know, us intelligent people. We are intelligent people, I hope. We're dealing with complicated problems. We might screw it up. You know, people have done so before. So it's always good to sort of remind ourselves of the fallibility of those in power, I think.
That was Jonathan Healy. His book, The Blazing World, A New History of Revolutionary England, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. You can read more about this transformative era in an article written by Jonathan on historyextra.com. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.